I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. This happened on Halloween of 2013. I was 16 at the time. Me and my sister Lauren, who was 13, and brother Jacob, who was 11, were on our own that very night. Our mom was taking care of our sick grandmother, and our dad was out of town on business. Trick-or-treating in our neighborhood always ended at around 9 o'clock. Our parents never made us go to school the day after Halloween, and it was so we could stay up past our bedtime and watch movies. However, since we were by ourselves and amped up on all the sugar we had consumed, we made other plans. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Wisconsin, but there are a lot of farms here. Our town was pretty much surrounded on all sides by them. In fact, there was a farm just outside our neighborhood, a short walking distance from our house. Every fall, this farm would have an annual pumpkin patch, and we thought it would be fun to go check it out. We didn't plan on vandalizing anything. We just wanted to stroll around and see how creepy the place was in the dark. The pumpkin patch was situated between two large cornfields. About a mile or so behind the patch was the house that the farmer lived in. For the sake of the story, we'll call him Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller had always given me the creeps. There was just something about him that I just couldn't put my finger on. The only way I can describe it is that he didn't seem to be a real person, if that makes any sense. It was like at any moment his skin would fall off and then reveal him to be some kind of alien or something. I know that sounds like a strange thing to say, but I'm telling you, there was always something off about Mr. Miller. The three of us arrived at the dark, deserted pumpkin patch at around 10 o'clock. There was a series of large sheds between Mr. Miller's house and the patch, so we didn't worry about being seen. I remember that there were always a couple of scarecrows off in the distance in the adjacent cornfields. The first thing I noticed when we got there was that there was a third scarecrow that was mounted in the middle of the pumpkin patch. I've been to this patch several times before. Our parents even took us here 2 weeks prior to pick out some pumpkins to make into jack-o'-lanterns, and I never remember seeing a scarecrow here before. It usually wouldn't really be any cause for alarm. It was Halloween after all, right? However, upon seeing the scarecrow, I instantly had a sinking feeling in my stomach. I looked to either side of me and saw the two usual scarecrows standing in the fields. I figured that maybe Mr. Miller wanted to be extra spooky this year. We wandered aimlessly around the pumpkin patch for about 10 minutes. Every so often I would look at the scarecrow and I could swear that its head would be positioned differently every time I'd look at it. It seemed to be watching the three of us as we made our way through the patch. I brushed it off as some kind of optical illusion, coupled with the fact that I was in some weirdo's creepy pumpkin patch in the dead of Halloween night. When we approached the scarecrow, Lauren instantly became uneasy. She was seriously creeped out by the figure. I pulled out my phone and turned on the flashlight to get a better look at it. Even from a distance, you could tell that the other scarecrows that were out in the fields were nothing but straw stuffed into some clothes. But this one was different. A lot of effort went into its design. It was mounted to a pole in the typical scarecrow stance. It was wearing a pair of dirty overalls with a red patterned flannel shirt underneath. Its head was a burlap sack with a jack-o'-lantern's face stitched onto it, and it was wearing a black conical hat with a pair of matching black boots. As my phone's dim light passed over its surface, I noticed these dark red stains on the overalls. As I was examining the straw man, Jacob, being the little shit that he was, came between me and Lauren. "I bet you're too chicken to take off its mask," he said. Me never passing up the chance to show up my little brother, accepted the dare, only on the condition though that he would have to forfeit all of his Reese's that he gathered that night. After Jacob agrees to those terms, I had Lauren hold my phone's light on the scarecrow while I made my way towards it. As I got closer, the sinking feeling that I mentioned earlier became stronger. However, my desire for those delicious peanut butter cups and the satisfaction I would get eating them right in front of Jacob overpowered my fear. Now only inches away from it, I slowly reached for the burlap sack. That's when the unthinkable happened. One of the scarecrow's arms shot forth, and the glove hand grabbed my wrist. The first thing I heard was Lauren screaming as the flashlight then vanished. The next thing I heard was two of my siblings taking off on foot, leaving me for dead. I tried pulling away, but the scarecrow's grip was too tight. I yanked and yanked, but it was no use. I then looked up in absolute horror to see that the scarecrow was now leaning forward on its pole and it was looking me dead in the eye. I was like a deer in the headlights. I stopped struggling and just stared back at the stitched-on grinning face. A muffled voice then came from beneath the burlap sack, and what was said really caught me off guard. "Happy Halloween." And with that, the scarecrow let me go. I never ran so fast before in my life. I hauled the hell out of there back towards my neighborhood. I met Lauren and Jacob outside the entrance to our neighborhood. They were really relieved to see that I was still alive. I'm glad I got to them before one of them called our mother, because we all could have been in some deep crap if she found out that we went to the pumpkin patch after dark. After giving them both a harsh scolding for ditching me, we walked home. Even now, it still baffles me to think that someone would be out there in the dark, deserted pumpkin patch long after it closed, dressed up as a scarecrow, just waiting for someone to come along. I don't know if it was Mr. Miller or one of his farmhands, but when my parents offered to take us back there the following year, all three of us promptly turned them down. I may have gotten the daylight scared out of me that night. However, I did really enjoy eating all of Jacob's Reese's Cups the following day. I'm not much of a storyteller, so bear with me. During the 90s, I went through a very rough time in my life. After a failed marriage, I became a bit of a nomad, wandering across the country on foot with no particular destination. It was a stupid idea, but I was in a very hopeless place back then and just looking to experience something new. I found myself on the back roads of Nebraska. For those of you who've never been to that state, there are large sections of land that go on for miles with nothing but cornfields lining either side of the road. I have been traveling down South Dakota and hitched a ride with a truck driver into Nebraska. We split ways at a rest stop, and I made my way into what I now know to be the Sandhills of Nebraska. The Sandhills region is one of the most isolated areas in the United States. 20,000 square miles of nothing but dunes and prairies. I planned on hitchhiking my way to the nearest town and catching a bus to visit a friend that I had in Omaha. Full disclosure, I had absolutely no idea what the hell I was doing. I subscribed to the "I'll just figure out when I get there" mentality. At the time, I didn't know a whole lot about Nebraska, but I found out the hard way that this stretch of road was not ideal for hitchhiking. I barely saw any cars going down this road, and the ones that did completely ignored me and drove right past. 12 hours passed and I was running low on food and water. I was utterly exhausted at this point, and I needed to find a place to rest for a while. I had about an hour left of daylight. Lucky for me, I happened to come upon an old farmhouse that was situated about a half mile away from the main road. From a distance, I thought that this place might have been occupied. But when I got closer, it was clear to me that the house was abandoned. This was around the fall, so the weather in Nebraska wasn't terrible. However, the nights were a bit on the cold side, so I decided to stay in this house for the night and then continue my journey the next day. I had enough supplies to last me one more night. The house was your typical rotting husk, smelled like mold, severe water damage, creaking floors, etc. The living room seemed to be the only decent place to settle down at, so I unpacked my sleeping bag and made myself at home, and eventually dozed off. I woke up to the sound of floorboards creaking. I immediately sat up and listened. I could hear several pairs of footsteps thudding all around the house. They were coming from upstairs, downstairs, on the back porch outside, and even in the same room with me. But I didn't actually see a thing. I quickly got to my feet and walked over to the nearest window and peered out. What I saw was truly alarming, and it sent a wave of nausea throughout my entire body. Several cloaked figures were standing side by side. They appeared to be encircling the house. Because of the footsteps I heard, I thought there may have been people in the house with me. So in an effort to defuse things, I made another big brain decision and spoke up. Hello? I'm sorry if I'm trespassing. I was just looking for a place to rest for the night, and I thought this place was abandoned. Again, I'm sorry. All the footsteps stopped at once, and eerie silence followed. It was so quiet that I could have heard a mouse crapping in the corner. I started to get a real bad feeling in my gut, so I reached into my backpack and pulled out my hunting knife. I gathered the rest of my things and moved slowly out into the hallway. Aside from the mysterious figures outside, I was also thinking of what was making the footsteps from inside the house. As I said, I heard several footsteps when I woke up, so I figured it wouldn't be long before I ran into someone inside the house. But after combing the entire downstairs, I didn't see or hear anything. I could tell that something was very off. That bad feeling that I mentioned earlier intensified. Despite the fact that I knew there were a bunch of weirdos in cloaks waiting for me outside, something told me that if I didn't leave the house that very moment, something terrible was going to happen to me. The house was located in a wide open clearing. Beyond the clearing was a barrier of tall grass. When I left through the front door, I then stopped directly in front of the house. No matter which direction I looked, I saw another hooded menace blocking my way. I suddenly felt this heat on my back, and I quickly turned around and was shocked to see that the house that I just left was now engulfed in flames. I cannot explain how this happened. Moments before, I was inside that house walking around, and now it was on fire. I backed away. I decided that I was going to run through the figures and then get the hell out of Dodge. But when I turned back around, the figures were now nowhere in sight. Things were getting way too bizarre for me at that point. The only thing I knew for sure was that I had to get the hell out of this place. When I got back out into the main road, I didn't stop walking until I finally got to a town whose name that I can't remember. The rest of my time in Nebraska actually went pretty well, and I got my life together shortly after I got back home from my trip. For as long as I live, I'll never forget that old farmhouse and those mysterious cloaked figures. This incident still baffles me to this day, but perhaps some things are just best left unanswered. I'm originally from Mexico, and for reasons that will become very obvious, I wish to remain anonymous. I was involved in the Mexican cartel. I mainly transported drugs across the border into the United States. To make a long story short, I was caught and cooperated with the feds in exchange for immunity and asylum. Before I go any further, you can all go ahead and label me a snitch if you want to. I don't care. I personally feel pretty good about ratting out a bunch of drug-dealing murderers who work for an organization that's responsible for destroying so many fellow Mexicans' lives. I was forced into this life at a young age. I've always hated the cartel, and I was already plotting a way to flee Mexico with my mother and two younger sisters. You could say it was a good thing that I ended up getting caught. This story is not about how I got out of the cartel, though. It's about the closest call I've ever had during my time with the cartel. This happened during the early days. It was the summer of 2005. I remember the date specifically because I had just turned 18 a day prior. Even though I was barely an adult, I was a very intimidating looking guy. I come from a long line of very physically strong men. I've been lifting weights since I was a child. I'm an even-tempered guy, and I don't even consider myself an aggressive person, but I'll put someone through a wall if they piss me off. It was because of my physical presence and my piece-of-crap father, who was also in the cartel, that made me a target for recruitment. When I first started out, myself and two other guys would drive around Mexico City and collect debts and packages from people who owed money to the cartel or one of our distributors. It was on the fourth or fifth run that we ran into some trouble. There was this particular club we frequented where a lot of business was conducted. To make things simple for you, an exchange would go down in a back room, and we would come shortly after and collect the revenue and then drop it off to our capo. So that night we entered the club and began making our way to the back room. It was a fairly busy night for the club. This DJ from out of town was performing there, so people from all over were there to see him. To get to the back room, we had to go through the main dance floor to the opposite side of the building. there were some renovations that prevented us from using the back entrance. We got out onto the dance floor and started making our way through the crowd. When we were about halfway there, I then saw something out of the corner of my eye. It was the barrel of a shotgun being pointed directly at me. I quickly ducked, and not a second later, I heard the gun go off. Unfortunately, an innocent girl who was standing beside me caught the bullet. She was shot at point-blank range, and I don't mean to be insensitive when I say this, but the poor girl's head was blasted apart. I remember several things happening simultaneously after the shotgun went off. All of the partygoers immediately fled the club. From my position on the ground, all I saw was a wave of moving legs. When I stood up, I saw a deserted club, my two co-workers with their guns drawn cursing up a storm, and unfortunately the corpse of the young girl who was just shot. I assumed that the shooter got away in the chaos. We quickly busted into the back office to find another bullet-ridden corpse. It was of the club owner who was our contact. We immediately fled the scene before the police showed up. I was never informed as to what happened with the club owner, and who almost took my head off with a shotgun. I was on the lowest rank of the cartel, and they kept us in the dark about a lot of the things. I'm very grateful that I'm no longer a part of that life. I'd like to end things by giving a big screw you to the person who tried to kill me and ended up shooting an innocent girl that night. And to all those cartel members who got locked up because of me, you got what you deserved, and I'll see you in hell. I grew up in the 1980s in a very tight-knit community in Georgia. When I was a kid, I used to love camping in my backyard. Almost every Friday night, me and my little brother Donnie would set up a tent in the backyard and spend the night playing with our G.I. Joes inside the tent. Our neighborhood was nice, but the surrounding area was a bit shady. You see, this was at the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, and within a few years our small town became infested by addicts and dealers. I remember there was an old man named Mr. Carl who was once a pilot in World War II. He used to live across the street from us. His wife died of cancer around 1984, and after that, well, he went off the deep end. 3 years after his wife's death, he became addicted to crack and began wandering the streets at night. It wasn't long after that when his house got repossessed by the bank, and Mr. Carl became homeless. Donnie and I would see him almost every morning sleeping on the bench at our bus stop. Sometimes he would be awake and would talk to us. We knew Mr. Carl well, so we weren't afraid of him, and he never tried anything with us. He was always just very friendly. After a while, Donnie and I noticed that Mr. Carl was no longer around. We asked our parents if they knew anything about what might have happened to him, but they didn't have a clue. I can't recall how much time went by since the disappearance of Mr. Carl, but I'd say it was at least a month. So one Friday night, me and my brother were in our backyard playing with these rubber band rifles that our dad had made for us. It was a piece of wood with a wooden clip glued to the top of it and a nail sticking out the front, so you could stretch a rubber band around the nail and clip it at the top. That way when you release the clip, the rubber band goes flying. Donnie and I were shooting at plastic toy soldiers when we heard something rustling in the bushes outside. Now, this is Georgia. We've chased away our fair share of raccoons and stray dogs, and with our new makeshift weapons, we were feeling extra brave that night. We decided to not go get our dad, and that we would handle the intruder ourselves. So we both exited the tent and made our way to the very back of the yard, where a chain-link fence separated our property from a small forest area. Donnie had brought the flashlight and was pointing into the forest just beyond the fence. When we got to the fence, a figure emerged from behind a tree. I recognized the jacket that the person was wearing. It was a dark brown bomber-style jacket, and I saw that the person was also wearing one of those army veteran caps. There was only one person I knew who wore a jacket like that. Mr. Carl. However, when I got a better look at the guy in the woods, it didn't look like Mr. Carl at all. He was definitely wearing his clothing, but the man appeared way too young to be Mr. Carl. I couldn't really get a good look at the man's face. He was looking down, so the bill of his hat concealed his features. That's when I noticed the dark red stains all over the man's jacket and jeans. Me and Donnie just stared at the man for about 30 seconds before asking him what he was doing back there. The man then reached down and grabbed a large axe that was laying at his feet and began coming towards the fence. My brother and I dropped our rubber band guns and then took off back towards the house. As soon as I turned around, I felt something fly past my head. I looked to the side to see the axe flipping through the air. It crashed into the tent, causing it to collapse. The rest of that night is a blur to me. According to my dad, when Don and I burst into the house, we were absolutely hysterical. It took about an hour to get the full story out of us, and by that time the mysterious man in Mr. Carl's clothes was long gone. I just remember my parents talking to a police officer in the living room later that night. There was never any follow-up, and I don't know if they ever caught the guy or retrieved the axe that he threw into our backyard. This incident effectively put an end to our Friday night camping, and we never figured out exactly what happened to Mr. Carl. I'm submitting this story anonymously. The reason for doing so will become apparent to all who are listening. I've had my eye on this channel for quite some time, and I deliberately selected you to tell my story. I like your voice, and based on your past content, I think you'll give this story your undivided attention. I don't mind your audience thinking I'm some kind of unhinged lunatic. Perhaps there's some truth to that. But I ultimately view myself as a result of a very unbalanced equation. I expect that this tale will not go over well with some folks. Allow me to respond to that by saying that I'm someone who truly does not care about the opinions of others. Most of you are naive and misguided, and sometimes even downright stupid. You can slap me with labels such as a sociopath, an asshole, incel, whatever you wish. But if I were to smash your bedroom window at night and rush to you with a knife, would your little insults really matter then? I'm guessing not. Now for the setup. I grew up in a very unassuming suburban environment with white picket fences and family barbecues. From a young age, I was aware that I've always had a capacity for violence. At the drop of a hat, I would have no problem bludgeoning someone to death with a fire poker. Not that I've ever done such a thing. But you get the point. However, the affliction of mine was always methodical. It served a purpose and was never beyond my control. There was this boy in middle school, we'll call him Kyle, who made the mistake of targeting me for his bullying antics, calling me disparaging names, throwing stuff at me, and even spitting on me during bus rides. I was only 14 years old at this time, but as soon as his saliva made contact with my skin for the first time, I then began plotting my revenge. You see, Kyle happened to live in the same neighborhood as me, so finding out where he lived was a simple task. Most of the houses between mine and his were still under construction. I spent about a month staking out his place from a nearby hiding spot and observing the routine of Kyle's family. Kyle was an only child, and both of his parents worked long hours, which might explain why he was such an asshole. I figured out that on Friday nights, Kyle was left alone. He would almost always have a pizza delivered to his house around 8 o'clock and would always order from the same place. Kyle was a creature of habit. During all this time, he would continue to pick on me during the bus rides, but I took it in stride because I knew what was coming his way. Everything about my plans seemed to line up quite nicely. You see, the front porch of Kyle's home was undergoing some kind of remodeling. The contractors Kyle's parents hired were careless enough to leave behind a very large crowbar laying on a bench right next to the front door. During one of my stakeouts, I swiped the object from the front porch before making my way back to my house two streets over. I think you know where this is going. On one Friday night, I made my way back to Kyle's place and then rang the doorbell at around 7:45. I stepped off to the side just in case Kyle looked through the peephole. I was wearing a mask to conceal my identity, but I didn't want to be seen because not even Kyle was dumb enough to open the door with a masked person standing on the other side. Fortunately for me, Kyle opened the door and wasn't even paying attention to what was in front of him. He was looking at what I believe was a Game Boy Color. Hay stood in the doorway for a few moments, fiddling with the Game Boy, before finally looking up. I wonder what went through his mind as the metal handle of the bar smashed into his face. Kyle collapsed onto the floor, and I stood on his front porch and watched him as he flailed around, cupping his hands over his nose. I wished I would have had time to give him a couple more whacks, but I knew that the pizza man would show up any minute, and of course Kyle's wails of pain would soon attract a neighbor. So I made my escape, darting between houses and making it back to my place without being seen by anyone. It was perfect, and of course the community was in an uproar. Not even our children are safe. Oh no! The overweight police chief even made a few appearances on local television stations, vowing that he would do everything in his power to capture whoever did this horrible crime. They brought the entire school into the gym to explain to us that one of our classmates was violently attacked. But to be honest, no one really gave a crap about Kyle. Kyle's nose had to be surgically reconstructed, and when he finally returned to school, he didn't seem to have any interest in picking on me, or anyone else for that matter. Aside from seeing an occasional patrol car cruising around my neighborhood, not much really changed. I wasn't planning on making an encore. Even at 14, I knew that luck had a lot to do with my plan playing out the way it did, and I was also smart enough not to push it. No one even looked my way. I was never questioned by the police, and they never found out who viciously attacked Kyle. I still have absolutely no regrets about what I did. Screw you, Kyle. You got exactly what you deserved. This all happened this year in 2024. When I first met Cheyenne, she seemed like a nice friend. We got along well, and soon she became part of our friend group. Everything seemed fine, and when she started dating my friend Sean, it felt like she was really becoming an even closer part of our circle. For a while, things were good between them, but then out of nowhere, she broke up with Sean over Messenger. It was really sudden and unexpected, leaving us all surprised. After the breakup, things took an even darker turn. Cheyenne left me a voicemail, the first of what would become a series of threatening messages. In that voicemail, she did something unforgivable. She used a racist slur, a word that no one should ever say, let alone direct at someone else. One of my friends who's African American was particularly hurt and angry when he found out. That one word shattered whatever was left of the friendship that we had with her. A few days later, Cheyenne sent me another voicemail. This time she was apologizing, to me at least. But even as she apologized, she made it clear that she had no intention of apologizing to Sean. I knew right away that her apology was fake. Just a way to manipulate the situation and maybe get me to side with her. It didn't work, but that wasn't the end. Months later, Cheyenne would do the same thing again, this time directing her racist and threatening behavior at another friend of ours who's also African American. It was beyond uncool. It was deeply hurtful and dangerous. Her actions made it clear that she was no longer the person we thought she was. Then came the day of the hit list. I received a message from a random phone number that contained a list of names, with mine at the very top. The message read,
"Hi, my name is Cheyenne,"
followed by the list of people that she was targeting. My name was first on that list. She continued to send threatening messages, one of which even said,
"Bitch, shut the hell up. If you don't like me, get my name out of your damn mouth."
I responded calmly, stating that I could call the police if needed, but the threats just kept coming. Something in my brain told me that I needed to take action. I knew that I couldn't just let these threats go unanswered. So I called 911. The police came to my house and I gave them my statement. They took the situation seriously, documenting everything. Having the police involved made me feel a little safer, but the fear still lingered. Cheyenne even went as far as to say,
"I know where you live, bitch."
This was no longer just an angry rant. It felt like a serious threat to my safety and the safety of my friends. We had no choice but to consider taking legal action. Cheyenne had crossed a line, and and her behavior was spiraling out of control. Throughout this time, Cheyenne tried to make me look like the bad guy. She texted my mom on Facebook trying to twist the story to make herself look like the victim and then paint me as the problem. And it didn't stop there. At one point, I called her out on her bullshit in another messenger group chat. I wanted to make it clear to our friends that Cheyenne was not someone we should trust. But the person who created the group chat didn't know what Cheyenne had been doing to the rest of us. I was mad at him for unknowingly giving her a platform. But later I forgave him through a text, understanding that he just didn't know the full story. Recently, Cheyenne moved into a group home that's close to where my girlfriend Bradley and Sean live. She's about half an hour away from me, but her proximity to my friends has added to the stress and concern we're all feeling. It doesn't help that my friend Ricky is obsessed with Cheyenne. Despite everything she's done, he seems fixated on her, which only complicates the situation further. Even though she's in a group home where she's close to my girlfriend and my friend Bradley, but a little ways away from me, it still scares me that she could get a job one day, collect enough money, and potentially come and find us to harm us. Mostly me, because I'm at the top of the hit list. As someone like me who's half blind, I don't think my pocket knife will defend me forever. Thankfully for now, I can enjoy my music and my audiobooks to calm me down, especially next week with my upcoming break until the new class starts. I might not be so lucky with the new teachers. It depends on if they'll be nice enough to hear my story and maybe let me listen to music while I do my work in the classroom. This just goes to show, guys, that if you feel like there's a friend who doesn't seem right, cut them out of your life. It's best to protect yourself before things escalate like they did for me.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
My girlfriend and I arrive at a remote stretch of forest around dusk. We saw two strange men sitting on some rocks, but didn't think much about it. We drove 2 to 3 miles further into the forest and set up camp. 30 to 45 minutes later, which yes, it was dark at this point, one of the guys walked up to our camp and yelled hello. I responded and he asked to walk through our camp. I asked him why, and he said he needed to reach to the other side of the creek. He walked around our car, and once he saw my girlfriend, stopped and had asked some strange questions. He crossed the creek, walked into some bushes, and then turned off his light. I stood at the bank of the creek watching him, and he just stared back at me for around 5 minutes. He eventually walked away, and we threw everything in the car and left. Also, there was nothing on the side of the creek that he crossed. No campsite, no trails, nothing. Weird behavior for sure. I didn't think much about it until he turned off his light and just stood in the bushes. Also, where was the second guy? There were no other campers at this stretch of forest, and we didn't see any vehicles. We were at the very last campsite on that road. There was nothing past us. This all happened like 3 hours ago, but we're now back home safe in bed. Me and a friend who I'll call Robert had just spent the day in a city a few hours away from our own. We had just spent a day at an event in which we had both participated in, and we had a blast. After the event, we decided to go out and get dinner with a group of our friends, and we ended up staying in the city until almost midnight before we decided we should probably get going. The drive home was very uneventful for most of the way home. The roads in between the two cities are very rural, with only a few small towns between the two. Since it was dark, we spent most of the drive looking for animals that may run out on the road while chatting with each other. As we got fairly close to Robert's house, we saw a car parked on the opposite side of the road facing the wrong way, and a man walking around and onto the next road. The car in front of us just so happened to be an ambulance, which then stopped to try and help the man. As we drove past, I made eye contact with him, and we continued on our way, thinking nothing of what just happened. We drove for another 20 to 30 minutes before turning onto the access road to get to Robert's house. As we got farther up the road, we noticed another car had turned on the road farther behind us. Robert lives in a gated community, so we had to turn onto the driveway so we could go through the gate. This is when we noticed that that car that had turned before had turned again and was right behind us. As we pulled up to the gate, Robert opened it and we drove right through. The car behind us had also managed to make it before the gate closed. Neither of us had really thought we were being followed until this point, but even then we joked about it. We then drove for a while inside of this neighborhood, which is fairly large, and we noticed this car was still behind us. The route we took was a large curve, so we figured he should have turned off by now. As we got close to his house, we decided to keep going as the road would loop around and confirm we were being followed. At this point, we called my friend's dad who had just watched us drive by with this car behind us. As we came around the loop, we come to the realization that we were actually being followed. Robert then started driving much quicker throughout the neighborhood, and the car behind us also sped up. We were going about 50 to 60 miles per hour on these fairly small roads, but the other car kept up. We drove for a while before we decided to head to the front gate, which had a 24-hour security guard, and we were still not sure if the person following us had a key fob to open the gate or not. We left the neighborhood and then pulled a U-turn back to the front gate. We were still driving very fast at this point, and to anyone it should have been apparent we were being chased. As we came back to the front gate, my friend was able to open it in a way where we wouldn't be able to be followed. But as we turned the corner, we saw the gate opening, and the car that was following us drove in. This is where we made a huge mistake. We had turned down a road without realizing it was a cul-de-sac. As soon as we noticed our mistake, Robert was able to flip the car around so we could get out of there. But as we drove by the car, I made eye contact with the driver, but I could just barely see his face. When we turned out of the cul-de-sac, we turned off the lights and booked it. We finally managed to shake it and get to Robert's house. We waited at Robert's house for the police to arrive, and shortly after the officer had arrived, he got a call on the radio and then booked it to his car. A few minutes later, two more police cars showed up, and we were then informed that they had found the car. The man was the same guy we had passed on the side of the road around an hour earlier. When the police first made contact with him, he refused to speak, and he didn't look like he was in the right state of mind. As the traffic stop proceeded, he then began threatening the officers. We later found out that he was a mentally ill and unstable veteran from a couple states over, and he had no reason to be anywhere close to where we were. The man had also broken the back gate when he followed us in. The worst of all is that the guy at the front gate, whose only job was to not let people in if they didn't have a fob without stopping at his booth, let the guy in after we had just sped past him. He was quickly fired by the security company. Looking back on this, there's only one thing that I probably would have changed. I would have called the police sooner, but the adrenaline in that moment really clouded our judgment. I'm a 20-year-old female, and this happened when I was around 15 to 16. I lived in a community for a few years, and there was this house that was two doors down that was always quiet. I never saw anyone enter or exit, but every year during Halloween, he would come out with a grill and give us soda, hot dogs, or hamburgers, and he was a really cool guy with crazy energy. Also, side note, he was an elderly man, maybe in his 50s, and we'll call him Ed. One summer, I went to California for a funeral, and my mom had called and said that Ed's daughter had come over, and had asked to leave some toys and clothes there because Ed had kicked her out, and her son just needed a place to store some stuff for a while. My mom was confused because we didn't even know he had a daughter, but my mom said yes. Ed somehow found out, and he said that we could have the rest of her stuff because she wasn't allowed back in his house. At this point, we had no idea why she was kicked out, and my mom never asked. So a few months later, I got home, and by this time, Ed's daughter had come and got all of her stuff, and I hadn't heard from her since. So one random day, he came to the door and dropped off some food he made. My mom thought it was weird, but we didn't eat it. We just kept the pan for a while to make it seem like we did. Then another day, he came and dropped off some movies that we never watched. Now, we had a Ring camera, and we would see him walk past our house looking at the door. One day, everyone was gone, and I was home alone, and I decided to walk my dog. And I kid you not, this grown man was sitting in the kid's sandbox and rolling around laughing, throwing it in the air. I walked by him, and then I noticed he was following me. So I cut my walk short and then went into the house and just stayed home until my mom got home. After telling her this, she was really weirded out. But this is where it got scary. My mom at the time was working overnight security at an empty hotel because this was during COVID. While my mom was getting ready, he came to our house and was pounding on the door like it sounded like a police officer or something. We didn't open it, and my mom didn't feel like it was safe to leave us home alone. She called her boss, and he said to just take us with her since the hotel was empty. We also had called the cops who had just talked to him, which didn't really change anything. There were also days where he would constantly bang on the door and we wouldn't answer. Then one day, he left a note on my mom's door. In the note, he stated that he loved my mom and that he wanted a romantic relationship with both me and my mom. Yes, the creep wanted to be with the both of us. And remember, I was a 15-year-old kid at this time. After that, we just avoided him at all costs. But by some weird coincidence, he got jumped by some other neighbors because he threw a rock at their window. We saw him get in an ambulance, and his face got all messed up. After that, and after some time passed, we eventually moved to the other side of town, and we haven't seen or heard from him since. I'm now much older, and I went by the house to see that it was empty. I don't know what happened to him, but I really hope that his sick self got some help and that he isn't around any kids. I'm a long-time listener, and this is my first time submitting a story. This is the first time I've shared this story outside of my immediate family and people who were involved in this situation. I'm using a throwaway account, as what I did wasn't exactly legal. This is kind of a long story, so get ready. I am now a 30-year-old female, but I was 25 when this happened. For some background, I started smoking weed when I was a freshman in high school. I continued smoking weed regularly up until the age of 25. By the end of my senior year in high school, I had already met major drug dealers or plugs and had some really good connections, so I started selling weed, but then that escalated to other drugs too, and weapons as well. It's important to know that I never did anything else. I didn't even smoke cigarettes. Only weed. Anyway, I became a big-time plug, and I was selling to a few small towns and big cities, so I was making good money. I would drive to Colorado whenever I was getting low, since weed wasn't legal in my state. One night, I was getting ready to go to Colorado, when let's call him Calvin wanted to come along for the ride. Now, this wasn't weird since we had made many trips to Colorado together before, so thinking nothing of it, I allowed him to come with me. Anytime he'd come with me, he would usually take his car, and usually I would drive there, and then he would drive on the way back. So fast forward to around 11 o'clock at night, and he messages me saying he's outside my house since we're gonna drive overnight. I got my duffel bag containing my change of clothes, my purse, and a backpack containing the money. I had approximately $25,200 in the backpack. Some of it was for shopping, and the rest was for dispensaries. As soon as I get outside, I see that he's already in the passenger seat, so I go around to the driver's side to put my stuff in the trunk. Once I got into the driver's seat, it was reclined all the way to the back, because he's 5'10", 200 pounds, and I'm 5'1", 130 pounds. So naturally, when I sat in the seat, I was almost in a laying down position. At this point, I still had my driver door open, so I decided to reach for it to close it. Then I would fix the seat to my liking. As soon as I reached for the door, three guys in ski masks with guns came up. One was at my door pointing a gun at my face. Let's call him Thing One. The other was at Calvin's door pistol whipping him. Let's call him Thing Two. And then the other was at the front of the car with his gun pointed at us. And yeah, we'll call him Thing Three. As the other guy is pistol whipping Calvin, Thing One moved his gun past my face to also point it at Calvin. And that's when I saw my chance to get out of the car. Now, me being small and in the position I was in the car gave for the perfect opportunity to slip away out of the car. And I did just that. I made it to the trunk of the car, and I could hear Calvin screaming. No words, just screaming. And I was in so much shock that I was frozen in place. It was when Thing 3 then yelled at Thing 1,
"Go get her!"
that snapped me back into reality. And I tried to run, but Thing 1 grabbed me by my hair and pulled me back. Now, at the same time this is all happening, Calvin is no longer screaming. And Thing 3 hops in the driver's seat while Thing 1 and Thing 2 are trying to get me in the back seat of the car. I'm trying to fight back, but they're constantly slamming my head on the car. At some point, they had opened the door to the back of the car and continued to try and shove me in the car. In the midst of that, I had stepped on the edge of the curve, which caused me to slip and fall in the car. My upper body was on the floor of the back seat, and my lower body was outside the car. Now they're slamming the car door on my shins, and all I can think is, if I let them drive away with me in the car, I'm dead. Thing 1 then went around and pulled me in the car, while Thing 2 shoved my legs in as he hopped in the car. Now I'm in the car in between Thing 1 and Thing 2, while Thing 3 is driving away with Calvin in the passenger seat. I realize he's not moving, so I'm thinking he's either dead or passed out. I forgot to mention that the backpack I had with the money had a lock, and only I knew the code. As we're driving, they're telling me to give them the code, but I refuse. Yeah, I know this was stupid of me. Well, they just kept hitting me and yelling,
"You're gonna die tonight! Now give us the damn code!"
All while pointing their guns at me. I managed to reach through the opening between the driver and passenger seat and jerk the steering wheel as hard as I could to one side, hoping and praying we would crash. But Thing 3 managed to control the car while I was then yanked to the back by one of them. After a short drive, we had arrived at this park that has a river running through it about 20 feet from the parking area and the woods across the street from it. They then got out of the car, yelling at me to also get out of the car, which I didn't want to do because I knew as soon as I did, they were going to beat me up until I was dead. I just held onto the steering wheel as they kept trying to pull me out of the car. Then one continued to pull me out while the other released my grip from the steering wheel. And then finally, I was out of the car. Thing 2 then grabbed me by my hair and then threw me across the parking lot like a rag doll. They wouldn't stop repeating,
"You're gonna die tonight,"
as one of them struck me on my jaw. And that's when I really felt it. My jaw dropped, like literally. He then began punching me in my eye, which almost caused me to lose consciousness, and I had to shake my head to keep myself from passing out, as I knew once I did, it would be easier for them to throw me into the river or leave me for dead in the woods. I never understood when people say your life flashes before your eyes, but in that moment, I understood. My life truly flashed before my eyes. I saw both of my sister's faces and my mom's face. They were all smiling. And all I could think about was, I don't want my mom to find my body floating in this river or in the woods. I kept praying to God that this wouldn't be the end of me, the finality of my life. With all of the adrenaline rushing through my body, I didn't really feel any pain. I only thought of my family in those moments. While all this is going on, Calvin is nowhere to be heard or seen. As far as I knew, he just remained in the passenger seat. Thing 3 then said to put me in the trunk, and that's when I truly knew I was gonna die, when all of a sudden Thing 1 says no to that, and they all throw my stuff out of the car and leave me alone. They get back in the car with Calvin still in the passenger seat motionless. They then peel out of the parking lot with my backpack and phone. I run behind a nearby tree with my stuff and just wait until I can no longer see their taillights. I then start walking the opposite way, hiding behind trees, as I'm afraid they'll come back and finish the job by running me over. I keep walking for maybe about 10 minutes until I encounter a couple, and I ask them to use a phone to call a taxi for me. They can clearly see the state I'm in, and they suggest they walk me to a nearby hospital, which I decline because at this point with everything that's happened to me, I just wanted to get home. They say that they don't have a phone, but that they can walk me to the Quick Trip gas station where I'll be able to call a taxi. Up until this point, I didn't know how badly I was injured until I got to the Quick Trip and people were looking at me like I had three heads. I call a taxi and make my way to the bathroom. It was when I saw myself in the mirror, when I saw the left side of my jaw was literally hanging down much lower than my right side. And that's when it hit me, when I think that they might have broken my jaw. I go back outside to wait for the taxi, and by the time I get back home, I realize it's now almost 3 a.m. They had me for almost 4 hours. By that point, the adrenaline is starting to wear down, so everything now, especially my jaw, starts to really hurt. I decided to roll up a blunt, as I think that it's going to take away the pain as well as my shakiness. While rolling up the blunt, I realized that I couldn't stick my tongue out, and that if I tried, it would hurt like hell, but I just figured that once I smoked, it would feel better. I rolled up, lit the blunt, and tried to inhale, then realizing I couldn't inhale or even lick my lips. My jaw pain was now way past a reasonable amount of pain, so I decided to drive myself to the hospital and just gave a bullcrap story about what happened, which I'm sure they never believed because we all know that a fall wouldn't have caused that much damage. I ended up with a broken jaw in 2 different areas, which required my mouth to be wired shut for 4 weeks, and I also had to be on an all-liquid diet since I could only drink through a straw. I also had a black eye, a bruised up body, and a very bruised neck and chest. I'm 90% sure Calvin set this whole thing up to rob me and just acted as if he was passed out in the passenger seat, because they never threatened his life or pulled him out of the car. And he was also the only one I told about going to Colorado that night. And no, I didn't get the cops involved, as what they stole was drug money, and I would have ended up in major trouble myself. I eventually found out who was behind the ski masks, and I got my best friend and his cousin to deal with them. Needless to say, I deleted and blocked Calvin, and of course, I left that life behind. I am now 5 years sober and have severe PTSD from this unfortunate event, but it made me want a career and turn my life around. So I returned to school, and I'm now an EMT with a much better life.